Cape Talk.
Health and wellness.
Always lovely to welcome back Dr. Darren Green. Great to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Talking Botox, and we're not just talking about taking wrinkles out of foreheads. And he had a look at my face as he came in and told him there's absolutely no need for it in my case.
Of course.
Darren, there are actually much more serious uses for it. Before we talk about those, let's backtrack a little bit. Yeah. What actually is Botox?
Yeah, a lot of people just know about it, but they don't know where it comes from or what it entails. And it's actually a toxin. It's like a neurotoxin. In other words, it has an effect on the nervous system of your body. And for those that don't know, there's a junction where a nerve connects to a muscle called the neuromuscular junction. So the nerve cell has to connect to the muscle to in order to communicate with it and tell it when to relax and when to contract. And what actually happens is at the surface of this nerve, there are little pockets or vesicles filled with a special neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. ACH. And acetylcholine, basically, the release into the space between the nerve and the muscle is essential for signal to go, you know, to the muscle and tell it to contract. What Botox does is it blocks the release of that neurotransmitter, acetylcholine, at the surface of that neuromuscular junction. And therefore, you then have an effect where the muscle can't contract and where it's actually temporarily paralyzed. And that brings about, obviously, the appearance of a relaxed muscle, firstly. Mm-hmm. Secondly, also, it's also utilized in so many other medical fields where a relaxed muscle is important and where it's necessary in certain medical conditions.
Let's talk about that, because I think most people think of it, relax the muscle in the forehead and make you have a nice wrinkle.
Cosmetically, yes, of course.
Cosmetic appearance. But let's talk about the medical applications. Yeah, because they are very, very diverse.
100%. And, the issue is simple things like hemifacial spasms. For those of you that have perhaps seen someone's eyes twitching, or even someone with a squint, for example, having strabismus, you can use Botox to relax certain eye muscles that are causing malalignment of the eye, if the eye is pulling towards the one side. How incredible is it to give them an eye that then you can then control and look, you know, at realigning the eye, for example? That's one use. So the eye muscles, things like laryngeal muscle spasms in the back of the throat, things like dystonia, where you have really stiff neck muscles and abnormal movements due to the neck muscle going into spasm constantly and you not being able to even look forward with your neck turned to the right or left and so forth. Quality of life is dramatically affected by some of these conditions, where Botox is then used to get you into a more functional, relaxed position so you can actually take part in normal activities and do your day-to-day tasks. Blepharospasm of the eyelids. So blephero refers to the eyelids, and often those can go into spasm too. Some people have motor tics. Some people have conditions where, for example, those muscles go into spasm and twitch constantly. And then obviously the facial spasms, where your whole face pulls skew at times. Different causes for all these things, but Botox certainly used for that. And then a big one that a lot of people know about is obviously the use in migraines, and specifically the association with that. And for those that have suffered with excessive sweating, or hyperhidrosis is a big medical term.
Yeah.
You often don't know how to cope with just having the tendency to perspire too much, and then you end up developing body odor because of the consistency of your perspiration.
The impact on confidence, etc.
Oh man, social life, work related clothing, you know, the displays of the excessive wet patches under your arms. Botox is used even in that for hyperhidrosis, with great results in terms of them injecting Botox just under the skin, for example, at those levels near the sweat glands. And it has a dramatic effect on quality of life. So a multitude of medicinal uses for Botox. So hopefully that'll change some people's view of it being just a cosmetic thing and a superficial, easy on the eye kind of, mechanism.
Couple of questions coming through from our listeners. And just a reminder, once we've dealt with the Botox questions, we'll move into an open line segment. So you're welcome to call in or leave a voice note with any kind of medical question. But Pat saying on the email, I've heard that Botox is the most lethal toxin known to man. And if that is the case, isn't it madness to contemplate using it unless it's absolutely necessary for medical reasons?
Yeah, so to understand what the toxin actually entails, you need to understand how potent and powerful it is. If you are infected with the organism that produces the Botox, so where do we get it from? There's a bug. There's a bacteria called Clostridium botulism. That's the one that actually makes the Botox toxin. This is found. It exists in nature in things like soils, in lakes and so forth, where it's not harmful at all. When it enters and becomes a vegetative state in the human body, for example, and multiplies, and the population of that organism multiplies with the release of toxin, a gram can wipe out an entire population. You could wipe out. It's really, really potent. So it's not something to be taken lightly, and that's why people that are ill in terms of infection, for example, with Botox, with the actual organism, they end up with paralyzed breathing muscles. For example, and they need to be ventilated until the toxin can either be can wear off and it's had its course. Because there's a lifespan to how long this toxin, even the ones that they use obviously artificially for skin and cosmetic stuff, purposes, have a maximum lifespan of about 3 to 4 months. Even in orthopedics, when they're trying to get muscles, people that have contractures and spasms and spastic muscles, et cetera, to relax the muscles, every three to four months they look at, you know, reapplying. And the big things obviously are how much Botox do you need in the different groups, because where it comes in is the skill of the person involved in injecting it and using it needs to understand the anatomy, needs to understand the risks in terms of how much to use, etc., and also needs to be aware of the side effects.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because somebody's just SMS'd saying, I've seen my dentist advertise that he does Botox. How can that be legal? Surely it's very specialized.
Yeah, so the problem with cosmetic Botox, there are obviously good bodies in South Africa that train you through internationally acclaimed standards in terms of applying, and you know, dentists are actually very good with knowing the anatomy of the head and neck.
Yeah, okay, that makes area. Sense.
So if you think about it, they specialize for many years in the head and neck, so they know the nerves of the face, the neck, maxillofacial surgeons even more so in detail, in great detail. But a lot of them obviously would then have to go on specialized training courses and be accredited. And not all courses are created equal. For the person out there, go and look at the credentials of the person you're seeing. Go and look at their experience. Go and look at their reviews. You know, do your research.
Before you let them near you with the needle.
That's just obviously just for cosmetic purposes. That's an entire ethical debate on its own, whether you want to age naturally or hide it. That's a different and a separate conversation.
We'll leave that
obviously.
For another day. Yeah, absolutely.
But in terms of the medical uses, certainly the different specialities would require that you are trained. I know in neurology, when I was doing neurology at Tigerberg with Professor Jonathan Carr, who would inject people with dystonia or movement disorders that were in really bad resting positions with spasms in their neck, for example, he would be administering the specified amount of units of Botox to assist with those muscles just relaxing and getting the patient more comfortable. Dramatic effects, I must
say. Okay. Very, very interesting to hear about those medical uses. Thank you. One last question here before we move into the open line. Anna's saying, is this the same as the botulism we used to be warned about from bad canned food?
Yeah, so botulism is the organism from Clostridium as well. And that's what the systemic infection is. So when you are injecting Botox, you're injecting just the toxin. You don't have the organism multiplying in your body with an inflammatory response to it in terms of an infection, a systemic infection. Thus, you don't develop, obviously, the effect of systemic paralyzed breathing muscles, for example. Yeah. And it's also about the units. If you think about it, for those that don't know, the amount of units on average that they would use for someone going to for cosmetic Botox would be something between 20 and 30 units for the entire face, for example. And that's at a cost of about $75 per unit. So it's quite expensive. I mean, you're looking at 2,500 rand generally for just the basic application. That's just from my own research.
Yeah.
I'm not
and that's
got
to be repeated 3 to 4 months, you say.
Yeah. So that would need to be repeated, or when the clinical signs of it. And you're not supposed to give Botox until someone has no clinical expression. You know, like, I'm so happy, can't you see? it's not supposed to be like that. It's supposed to be used, well, in this case, obviously, to get people into a position where the furrows are relaxed for cosmetics. But as I say, I'm more, I tend to speak to you more from a medicinal point of view in terms of using it for other medical causes.
Thank you for filling us in on what those were. With that, we'll move into the open line section. You're welcome to call us on 021-446-0567. You can send your question as an SMS to 31567 or a voice note to 072-567-1567. Somebody has used that number to ask, is there any way to remove a dowager's hump? Am I right in thinking that's the sort of the curvature of the spine that comes as you age?
In terms of the hunchback of Notre Dame, looking at the back of the pad at the back of your neck.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you're looking at that, so what you have there is a loss of lordosis of the spine in terms of the cervical spine, so the C spine. So, you know, the Afrikaans people speak about a bochelruggie.
Okay.
And from wearing stilettos for long periods of time, I must say it does definitely play a massive difference in those posture muscles. I think everyone should do ballet. That's what I think. The whole world should do ballet. It'll help pull them up on a string and get decent posture in the upper body and the neck. But, you know, they have other side effects, the poor ballerinas.
I'm all for banning the high heels as the simpler approach there, Darren.
I mean, they do look good on certain people, but hell, you know, we need to think about this long term. And the problem is that lordosis, that curvature of the C spine, the cervical spine, is crucial in maintaining posture. And if you think about it, all your muscles hang on this frame, your shoulder girdle, your trapezius muscles, your rotator cuff, then on the shoulders, etc. And those are the muscles associated with posture and also mobility of the upper body completely. So, you know, when you lose that, and if you have spasm, for example, of the neck, you find the vertebra pull quite straight. If you look at an x-ray of someone that has neck spasms, those vertebrae, the seven vertebrae of the neck would be zipped up quite tightly. That would have lost its curvature.
Okay.
But because of the long-standing postural tendons and the lack of stabilization of the spinous ligaments as well as the stabilizers of the neck and accessory muscles, you lose, obviously, the ability to keep the neck upright, and then it protrudes forward.
Okay.
And then you'll see your chin then dips forward, and that's how you then get that. People that get older, what typically happens to them? They get shorter. Why? Because the spine collapses. The spaces between the vertebrae become narrow. The angles, as I've mentioned, and those curvatures change as well. And they end up, obviously, with a posture where their face is actually looking downwards at the ground naturally instead of looking up at the horizon because of that lordosis.
Somebody's recommending yoga as the answer. What else can you do, if anything, to correct this?
Absolutely. So Pilates is absolutely something really underrated in terms of spinal health. And yoga, absolutely phenomenal. I mean, the effects of using yoga, not only for the benefits in postural control, but also in terms of breathing, and even more so with the brain in terms of mindfulness and concentration and that kind of thing, and looking at how to have selective attention, focus, I think are absolutely understated, and we need to incorporate them into our natural day-to-day lives.
Okay. Thanks very much for the tip on the yoga, by the way. Let's go back to Botox. Rose and welcome, Glenn, wondering whether Botox can be used for arthritic joints at all.
No. So if you think about joints are bones, and where Botox is actually effective is working on muscles and the joint junction between a nerve and a muscle specifically. So sure, if there's spasm overlying a joint that's preventing it from moving, or getting into a comfortable position, then relieving the spasm via Botox might be able to help, depending on the cause of the spasm. If it's a stroke, for example, that's got damaged brain that's leading to the cerebral palsy type of picture, you might need a contracture release and formal surgery. And Botox might not be the right thing for you, depending on the size of the muscle group.
Okay. This is such a good question, because I think it's something that so many people are not sure of. So thank you for asking it. Please explain generic medicine. I was prescribed tamoxifen, but the name on the bottle says neophedin.
Yes.
Great
the word
question.
Generic.
Thank
generic.
You. Yeah.
Firstly, generic and genetic have nothing to do with each other. You'll be surprised
how many people confuse the
word. It sounds quite, arbitrary. But anyway, so a generic basically is where you have different medications that exist on the market where the active ingredient in these different medications would be the same molecule. Now, that means that the tablet means that the active ingredient in a simple tablet is combined with things like colorants, like flavorants, like preservatives, etc. And the compositions differ according to which pharmaceutical company, it comes from. So you'll find the active ingredient in the same volume or same, the same quantity, really, being produced. But the effects and the absorption might be different depending on the preservatives and the additives, the things that are added to the combination. So certainly the active ingredient is marketed and tested as the same molecule. You get also what is called a clone, where it's exactly the same. But how it works is when a company spent millions and millions of rands proving that a drug is useful and paying for all the research and studies and then gets it registered, they have a period. Yeah, they have a patent time when they can be the sole manufacturers or marketer of that drug. And then that runs out after, say, 5 years or whatever. Then other companies, generic companies, can then produce the same active ingredient at a reduced price and cost. So that's how the industry works. Are all generics created equal? In clinical opinion and clinical experience, no. There are certainly side effect profiles. You might be not allergic to the original and become allergic to the generic, for example, due to the composition of the chemical composition of the medication. Yep. And that needs to be documented. An adverse event needs to be reported to the practitioner that's prescribed it in the first place, or to your pharmacist, so that it can go back. Can't tell you how many batches of medication have then they release a formal callback for batches of medication that have perhaps gone out and caused adverse reactions. And if we don't report the adverse reactions, everyone thinks that, you know, the medication is working and it's fine. So you owe it to the rest of the world. If you have an adverse effect to a drug,
let your doctor know.
Let your pharmacist or your doctor know, please. It's the right thing to do.
Okay, good advice. Thank you. And thank you so much for asking a very important question.
Indeed.
Interesting one here from Anonymous on the email, saying, I've had a couple of light dizzy episodes. Not really dizziness, but more a feeling of lightheadedness for just a couple of seconds where I sort of lose focus and then have to zoom back in. I'm in my early 40s. Should I be worried?
Yeah, I mean, lightheadedness can be caused by so many different things. From, I mean, the big three that I always, when I speak to the sisters that do the triage in our emergency unit, I say, when someone comes in and complains about dizziness or lightheadedness, check the blood pressure, check the sugar, check the iron levels or the hemoglobin levels, and then, of course, the cardiac rhythms, the rhythms of the heart. Just in a nutshell, those four things are really big, quick answers and reversible causes immediately to identify that can point you to systemic illness in the different systems. So yeah, as a symptom, lightheadedness, interestingly enough, often accompanies those four things: blood pressure, sugar, iron levels of hemoglobin, and then a heart rhythm disturbance, either of those. But when it comes to high blood pressure, because everyone thinks that, you know, they're giddy, feeling giddy, it could be my blood pressure. 100%. Low blood pressure makes you feel queasy, like you're going to pass out. You feel weak, tired, exhausted from low blood pressure. And when you change position from sitting to standing or lying to standing, you often feel the world spin and so forth. Typically, your body can't up the pressure quick enough for you, and that's why you feel so dizzy. But high blood pressure, funny enough, the presenting complaint, the most common complaint, is just feeling a little bit of giddiness and a bit of a spaced out sensation of lightheadedness. Headache as a symptom, to everyone listening out there, is not a main presenting symptom of high blood pressure. And it's important for people to know that. An aneurysm, on the other hand, which is a blood vessel in the brain that has a weakened vessel wall and forms a sac and can burst and cause a bleed in the brain, that can cause headache. And that's a different entity completely. So just remember, you know, everyone that has a headache doesn't have high blood pressure.
Okay, thank you. Linked to blood pressure, the follow-up question here from someone saying, I'd like to know a little bit more about low blood pressure. How low is too low, and what other underlying issues could it point to?
Yeah, first you need to know what normal is for men and women, and the difference, and children, for example. So look at the age guidelines. That's a simple Google search for you. But understanding that women generally have lower blood pressures of about 110 over 70, and typically you'll find that they cope. But that's got to do with their muscle mass in general, and also their size. Blood pressure is often proportionate to your body size, as well as the muscle content and the size of your frame, quite often. But certainly we are definitely aware that low blood pressure is often caused by dehydration, because the blood volume itself is dependent on water to keep it flowing. If the blood is too thick, it clots and puts you at risk for stroke, for example. So dehydration right at the top of the list of low blood pressure, and certainly a simple reversible cause. And then obviously obviously, if you're too low on salt, salt holds onto water and ups the blood pressure. So often you'll see someone saying, if you feel queasy and have low blood pressure, have some salt and vinegar crisps. Mm. And often they feel fantastic after that. There are other sources of natural sodium and salt, for example, that you might need. But obviously, if you're self-medicating, you should have your sodium checked and blood pressure certainly measured to have a look at what you've been eating and the dietary effects on your blood pressure too.
Okay. Gosh, somebody just SMS saying, in my last pregnancy, my blood pressure was 75 over 50.
Oh, that's
How
a different
are you
cause,
even
though.
Upright?
Yeah. So when you're lying, you have aorta vena cava syndrome as well, where when you're lying on your back, you have obviously the uterus that's swollen and big, giving a pressure effect on the vena cava, with the venous blood that's going back, obviously, to the heart. And you have then clinical features of that, also feeling quite dizzy and a bit queasy. And if you want to pass out, and we often say then lie on your side, lie on your left side, so there isn't pressure of the abdominal pressure pressing down on the big venous blood vessels.
Makes a lot of
sense. Return to the heart.
That's where we must leave it. Darren Green, always great to
have you with us. Great questions. Thank you so
really
much.
Nice questions today. Well done, everybody. And
thank you.
Chat to you in a couple of weeks.
Indeed.